I also would like to remind you again about the need the Institute has for donations. We are wholly dependent for our funds to operate, as most of you know, on both memberships and donations. We have this year worked out an arrangement with the tax department whereby the Institute can give you tax deductibility for, I think, both memberships and donations, and we therefore make an appeal for you, to you, to consider us as a recipient of donations which might be tax deductible. Now, our speaker tonight is the Master of Corpus Christi College, Cambridge, Michael William McCrum, and he's the last of our 21 speakers in this, our 69th continuous year of operations. He is said by others in his field and of his generation to be one of the most influential educators in England today. Our speaker's family are Scots who emigrated to Ireland in Jacobite days, as did many Western Protestant Scots. His family were very naval, in his words. He has an uncle who was a Royal Naval Admiral. His father and two brothers reached the sub-flag rank of captain. And while Master McCrum, as his title at Cambridge entitles him to be called, wished from a very early age to be a teacher, he was made to feel very black sheepish about this ambition. By reason of World War II and after his schooling at Sherborne, where he finished in 1942, he himself joined the Royal Navy. Despite his very grand naval connections, our speaker spent the first 9 months of his naval life in what we then, probably still now, call the lower deck. He was a CW candidate, which meant that if he showed what we used to call OLQs, officer-like qualities, he would, at the end of his 9 months, be rewarded with a commission as a sub-lieutenant, Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve. Our speaker said to me of this period of his life that at that stage you are a marked man. Your cap has a white band. You are neither lower deck nor commissioned officer. Thus, you are excluded by both groups. The only relief comes at the end of the training. Now, Master McCrum did, however, have a reward, in my view. It came in the form of what I would call a couthing course. The last 2 weeks of his training in 1943, right through the Christmas season, he was billeted at the Royal Naval College, Greenwich, ostensibly to learn how to handle a knife and fork at table, but also to how to handle himself in the wardroom. He dined each day in that wonderful painted hall at Greenwich, in the Naval Academy. The balance of his almost 3 years of service was spent as a sub-lieutenant in the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve, serving aboard the battleship HMS Howe and the aircraft carrier HMS Victorious at sea in the Atlantic, Indian, and later the Pacific Oceans. To a man who has spent his professional life developing values in his students and having achieved his national, even international, reputation in this function, I suggest that this life experience has not been far from his thoughts since. His life at Corpus Christi College started immediately after he was discharged from the Royal Navy in 1946 and has continued to this day. He took a classics degree with a first-class standing with distinction in 1948. He then began his teaching career, first at Rugby, Warwickshire. As you will know, Rugby is, and has been since the middle 1800s, been one of the first-rank English public schools. He remained at Rugby for just 2 years. He was then elected a fellow at Corpus Christi and invited to return to the college. He was given very sensitive and demanding responsibilities. He was tutor and director of studies in classics. As tutor, he was responsible for all admissions to the college, both undergraduate, something in excess of 200, and postgraduate, which later came to be almost half as many as the undergraduates. He was responsible for the welfare of all students in the college. He was responsible for the administration of the general teaching program at the college, and he is well lectured, 5th and 4th century Greece and 1st century Rome. I should tell you something of Corpus Christi. We have had this season, and are having tonight, our second head of a college, and it's sort of amusing to me as we mark with some pride our 69th year to think of Corpus Christi. It's the 6th oldest of the 29 Cambridge colleges. It was founded 633 years ago in 1352, 100 years earlier than Eton College. It was founded under a license granted by Edward III, who you will remember reigned for 50 years from 1327 until 1377. One of its buildings, with typical English understatement, is called Old Court. It's the oldest continuously inhabited court at Cambridge. While the college is small, it's acknowledged to be relatively well off, with an excellent academic and athletic tradition. Its postgraduate population, it being half the size of the undergraduate population, is by college standards at Cambridge very large. Now, Master McCrum remained at Corpus Christi as fellow of all talents, I call him, for some 12 years. In 1962, he was appointed headmaster of Tonbridge. He thus renewed his earlier career in the English public school system. Tonbridge is a large English public school. He remained there for 8 years as head. And in 1970, he was appointed headmaster of the premier public school in England, Eton College. Eton has a very large school population, some 1,200 students. He remained at Eton for 10 years and then left to come back to Corpus Christi. For those interested in college life, you'll know that I was able to determine from his biography that one of his first administrative acts as the new warden was to redesign and re-equip the kitchen at the college so that the students would not be poisoned by various bugs and things that might be found in this ancient kitchen. Now, our speaker's extended influence over the English schooling system had commenced in 1974. He was then elected chairman of the Headmasters' Conference. At various times, he's been a governor. That's one of the group who supervise headmasters of some seven of the leading English public schools. He's presently a governor of Rugby, Sherborne, his school, King's College Canterbury, Oakham, one of the largest co-educational schools in England, and he's on the board of the United World College of the Atlantic in Wales, which is the sister college to the Pearson College at William Head in Victoria. He's also an honorary freeman of the Skinner's Company, one of the ancient and honorable great companies of the city, whose main interest is the sponsorship and government of some four public schools, one of which is Tonbridge. He is now the deputy chairman of the Governing Bodies Association. I choose to think that his primary qualification for speaking to us tonight is that his paternal grandmother was a Canadian. She was, importantly, the first lady to graduate in mathematics from McGill. So our speaker is thus, in my view, very well qualified to speak to us on elitism, egalitarianism, and excellence. Master McCrum.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Vogel, for that introduction. I hope that everybody has got a copy of my outline of my talk. It'll be easier to fall asleep if you haven't got it. And the object of it is that if you do doze off, or when you doze off, and you come to, you can see quite quickly where I've got to. And I will refer to it from time to time by letters, you know, C4, for the benefit of those who I see sleeping in the background. May I start with a true story? Some years ago, David Jenkins, before he became the theologically and politically controversial Bishop of Durham, who last year brought the virgin birth into the... forefront of everyday conversation, was visiting New York. There, he met a medical friend who had just spent a fascinating morning at Columbia University watching a very difficult operation to remedy the congenital deformity of a young child soon after its birth. A large group of top consultant specialists watched this most complex operation, men whose skill was the fruit of the excellence of their education. They had been to a good school and a good university. The operation was completely successful. And then later, the same day, David Jenkins was shown the conditions in Harlem from which that child came, a rundown home where there was risk of every sort of disease. Every relevant skill of human knowledge had been put at the service of keeping the child alive and making it as fit as possible for the years ahead. But when it returned to its home environment, it would, within a few months, he was told, almost certainly die. Here, starkly contrasted, was the case for excellence and the case for equality. Why in our modern Western world should such poor home conditions be allowed to exist? Is it fair to spend so much on educating those who already have considerable ability and so little on those who have not? With not enough money, as we're all well aware today, for all we should like to see done, where should our priorities in expenditure lie? If excellence is the fruit of elitism, why is elite today regarded by so many as a five-lettered word? Will excellence before long take on derogatory overtones? How can we justify aiming for the highest unless we recognize to the full the needs of the lowest? My plan this evening is first to consider the nature of elites and elitism in respect of schools and universities, then discuss equality and egalitarianism, and finally suggest how these two apparently contrasting attitudes might be reconciled. Until quite recently, the word elite had none of the derogatory overtones that we now tend to associate with it. A comparative newcomer to the English language, its first attested use in the Oxford English Dictionary being by Byron in the year 1823 in his poem Don Juan. There it meant simply the choice part or flower of society or of any body or class of persons. Can people read that? No. Can we switch to the whiteboard? No.
It's too far to the right.
Could it be on the whiteboard?
From either the board or on to the whiteboard? Okay, could you do that? Thank you.
It was simply the choice part or flower of society, being the old French version of the Latin past participle from eligere, electus, meaning chosen. The word's gradual decline in respectability was, as Raymond Williams has plausibly argued, probably due to the changing conditions of the 19th century society and the emergence of such new kinds of distinction as expressed in rank, order, and class. Were those most suited for government and positions of influence best identified by their social position? Coleridge's clerisy, Mills's the wisest, were attempts at defining a different governing group whose suitability was assessed by merit rather than birth. And later, Pareto's and Mosca's more formal analysis of the concept developed the modern picture of elites as political groups competing with one another for power and concerned with their own interests rather than with those of society as a whole. Surprisingly, perhaps, elitism, as advocacy of elite dominance or leadership, was not coined until 1950, but from the outset it was derogatory, as is made clear in Hunt's Guide to Communist Jargon, where he writes, "Lenin's conception of the narrow party consisting of an elite whose more highly developed class consciousness enables it to see further than those among whom it works. But this elitism is anti-democratic." As Williams has pointed out, today the word, combining opposition to the informal sense of government or influence by the best, with opposition to the political and educational procedures designed to produce elites in a more formal sense, is often so used that the precise nature of the opposition is not always clear. Is it opposition to government by a minority or to education for a minority? Or is it rather a more general opposition to all kinds of social distinction? The confusion between these two senses tends to obfuscate discussion of how ideas about elites are related to those about a ruling class. But whatever the historical reasons for the development of the meaning of elite and elitism may be, we are probably all agreed that today both words tend to be used more often than not in a derogatory sense, as for example by Rupert Murdoch, the newspaper tycoon, in a recent interview where he was talking about the Times newspaper's bicentenary, and he said, "One of the things that's wrong with this country," and he was talking about the United Kingdom, is its all-pervading elitism. Now, I wish this evening to argue that elites are necessary in any dynamic country. That is, creative groups with particular skills to offer to the community at large. Elites are unquestionably bad if they become exclusive, because then their ultimate fate is to spend their energies on keeping outside their charmed circle those who wish to come in. Elites, however, that are continuously glad to recruit those from any source who have the appropriate skills and talents, and who use those skills to enrich society, are desirable. No one derides elites in leisure activities. Tottenham Hotspurs or Manchester United in England are football elites, and no doubt you have your ice hockey elites. And these give their many supporters much pleasure. Our top actors, crème de la crème indeed, attract admiration and applause. Most professions have an elite, the law and medicine being two very obvious examples. John Wayne put this point well in Encounter some years ago. That corruption of the democratic ideal, which asserts as a dogma that what all can't attain, no one must, a corruption that would make high achievement impossible in physics as in politics, in basketball as in cooking, in engineering as in acting, infallibly leads to an important dismissal of craftsmanship and knowledge as elitism. Not thinking so ill of democracy, which has always seemed to me a noble ideal, I cannot see why it should not be part of the richness of human life that many or most skills and crafts should be within the reach of people who are born with such a gift and have labored to develop that gift. We can, of course, always imagine a bad elite, an elite based on privilege and money, admitting no one to its ranks who had not been to the right schools and been elected to the right clubs. This elite would be bad because it would exclude people of imagination and integrity on irrelevant grounds and thus impoverish itself. And if it were in a dominant position within the culture, it would impoverish the whole culture. But I can see nothing wrong with an elite that can be joined by anyone who is prepared to do his homework, take trouble, be self-critical. That's John Wayne. What is needed in any country, in its schools and universities, as much as in non-educational spheres of activity, is that quality, in whatever form it is found, should be valued, encouraged, developed, that skill and talent should be esteemed, not denigrated. What must be avoided at all costs is what John Wayne calls jelly-bellied democratization. In a mass society, only the lowest level of fineness is acceptable. Now, while many might be willing to concede that the sort of elites that I have been talking about are tolerable, if not indeed necessary, that there is an important role in a dynamic society for such elites as the political, the organizing, the intellectual, the artistic, the moral, the philosophical, the scientific, as Karl Mannheim and T.S. Eliot have suggested. Elites that are directly or indirectly associated with political or quasi-political power tend to be less acceptable than the others. And it is in England, in the argument over the type of education, especially in schools, that children should have, that the clash between elitism and egalitarianism is seen at its clearest. It is perhaps conceded that countries need creative minorities or elites. The danger is thought to come from the type of elite created by the system. In its extreme form, the egalitarian's belief is that all children should be treated equally, even if this is at the expense of the more intelligent children, for whom no adequate academic incentive can thus be provided. In a modified form, the egalitarian believes that the country's educational system should be mainly concerned with giving the great mass of children as equal an opportunity as possible in non-selective schools to develop their personalities and abilities in their own way to the limit of their capacity. while the so-called elitist believes that since men vary in their abilities, the educational system should be so organized as to allow the ablest, whatever their social origins or economic handicaps, to rise to the top, and yet without depriving the less able of a good education. Though there is much that is attractive in the egalitarian view in terms of social justice, it tends to mediocrity and is at root unrealistic as long as there is shortage of money for education. In English terms, which do not, I understand, apply to Canada, if selective education, whether at school or higher level, ceases to be available, many of the ablest children will not have the opportunity to develop their intellect to the full. Put at its crudest, the question is, if either the most able or the least able have to do with less material encouragement, which should suffer the disadvantage? It is, of course, important that in any sophisticated technological society like Canada or the United Kingdom, there should be a high average level of education. And this requirement has, in the years since 1965, fully justified the money spent in my country on making our government-maintained system of secondary education less selective. But ours is a trading community with limited and comparatively few natural resources, which depends for its livelihood to a greater extent than many countries on its brains. We cannot afford, like America, to waste our intellectual manpower. In the last two decades, since Mr. Crossland's famous circular 1065, the percentage of English children educated in maintained grammar schools has dropped from some 25%, a quarter of all the children, at its highest, to a mere 5%. Those schools which provided the greatest impetus to social mobility in the past and enabled so many in England of today to reach the top from humble backgrounds have been largely absorbed into what we call comprehensive schools, or destroyed, or driven into the private sector as their only refuge. Harold Wilson once said that the English grammar school would be destroyed over his dead body. Alas, he's still alive. Only a few solidly Tory county administrations, such as Buckinghamshire or Kent, have retained any grammar schools at all. So what we call the public schools have come to bear the brunt of the egalitarian attack. At this point, I had better try to define the term public school. Some of you perhaps know the old epigram, that the English public school is English because its chief study is Latin, public because it is private, and a school because its main preoccupation is games. We seem to have gone backwards instead of forwards. Try again.
Try that. There you go.
One more. There we are. Our public schools are independent of the state, privately funded from fees and endowments, and governed by independent and political boards and non-political boards of trustees whose sole purpose is to manage their particular school to its best advantage. Since in Canada it would be confusing to use the term public school of these private schools, I shall in the rest of this lecture call them private or independent, and the state schools maintained, that is, maintained by the government using taxpayers' money. If I spend some time considering this egalitarian attack, it is not because I have spent 20 years of my active life working in them, but because the clash between elitism and egalitarianism, with all its ramifications, is so starkly seen therein. The attack comes on three main fronts, all interlinked: class divisions and divisiveness, the power and influence of this particular elite, and the evil effects of academic selection. Let me try to deal with these separately in turn, so far as that is possible. First, class. P.E. Daunt, in a most useful book called Comprehensive Values, provides a good example of the sort of criticism I have alluded to. I believe, he writes, that there is nothing more important for education in Britain than the total elimination of the independent schools, because they, far more than any other single institution or custom, perpetuate the hoary social curse of the uniquely divisive and persistent English and Scottish class systems, which falsify humanity and debilitate society. In almost all such views, the word class is seldom defined, presumably on the ground that its meaning is self-evident. And since its three main social meanings are frequently merged, the confusion over its use is compounded. The Latin word classis, from which it comes, does of course mean division, originally a division of the Roman army. And today the word is still used non-controversially, as we are all well aware, both in education, in school terminology, when we say of some pupil that he's top or bottom of his class, or that a particular class is doing well in its studies, and in discussing the classification of, let us say, plants or animals. It becomes a hate word only when it moves into discussion about society, when the objective social or economic sense of group, for example, the working class as a productive labor force, is combined with the sense of rank or relative social position in the hierarchy, for example, lower, middle, and upper. And these two develop into the third sense of formation, for example, working class as a political entity with a position to fight for. Most left-wing critics divide British society rather crudely into two main groups, the proletariat and the rest, or the workers and the wealthy, or the people and their rulers. But this simplistic division, or even a division into three classes, lower, middle, and upper, fails to convey the social complexity. The German scholar, recently principal of the London School of Economics, Dr. Ralph Dahrendorf, is reported as saying that he saw the so-called British class structure as an enormously complex and evolving patchwork, not a three-decker sandwich to be defined with idiotic simplicity. We have indeed in England a great variety of social groups, not differentiated by a single factor, such as birth or occupation or income, with overlapping membership. The clergy, for example, are mostly poor, though a few have inherited wealth, by no means all from a similar social background or with a similar education, and a few, such as bishops or deans, with social or political influence. Leaders of the main trades unions have greater power and influence than many of those in government, but wouldn't think of themselves as members of the ruling class until they reach the House of Lords. Sorry about the screen. I mean, this is there's colour in that picture, actually. In Britain, membership of a class is, for many, highly subjective. People place themselves where they wish. The middle class is, for obvious reasons, the most popular choice. But two further points need to be made. First, all advanced societies have a class structure because it answers a man's social needs. And second, I don't think there's any harm in that. Indeed, there is positive social benefit, provided that social mobility from class to class is not too difficult. In this century, we have seen the first point very clearly illustrated in the USSR. The pre-1917 class structure, the imperial structure and the hierarchy depending from the emperor, was deliberately destroyed with the intention of creating a classless society. And all that happened, as we know only too well, was the replacement of the ruling class by another. Hilaire Belloc's well-known couplets on oligarchy and democracy come to mind at this point. The accursed power which stands on privilege and goes with women and champagne and bridge broke, and democracy resumed her reign, which goes with bridge and women and champagne. That was a verse on an election and underlies the second point, that unless there is enough social mobility for people of talent to rise to the top if they wish and if they deserve by their efforts to do so, the harm done by class outweighs its merits, its benefits. Britain is indeed a class society, but which country in the world is not? Is not, however, a closed, much less a caste society. Real talent can always get to the top or near it, even in one generation. Mrs. Thatcher and her two immediate predecessors at No. 10 Downing Street had no advantage of an English private school education and were not members of the ruling class. Such mobility is not restricted in England to politics. As Bauer, P.T. Bauer, put it, we have never since Elizabethan times had serious barriers to moving up and down, up or down social ladders. Our statistics suggest a high and constant rate of mobility equal to that of the United States and greater than that in Western Europe. Only a quarter of those in the Registrar General's social class, one, managers, professionals, have fathers in the same category. Fewer, indeed, than those drawn from a manual working-class background. The majority move upward rather than downward. The middle class has grown and is growing at the expense of the working class. We have, since the 39-45 war, seen that what breaks down class barriers most effectively is increasing economic prosperity. For this leads both to greater social mobility and to the capacity of the hitherto less well-to-do social groups to enjoy the leisure opportunities, interests, avocations formerly associated with the upper income groups, the widespread possession of cars and sailing dinghies and the enjoyment of holidays abroad are just a few illustrations of that. Of the two revolutions which were identified by the Hungarian emigre economist Lord Balogh, Marx and Marx and Spencer, the second is the more effective in the long run in reducing class differences. Who in England today does not wear Marks and Spencer clothes? All the evidence seems to show that what does not break down class barriers is common schooling. It is tilting at windmills to attack class structure through schooling. The research of Dr. Julian Ford, Douglas Holly, Christopher Jenks, Thorsten Hussein all point the same way, that schools are ineffective as places for social engineering. Jenks, in his fundamental study of inequality, confirmed the researches of Holly and Ford. He reluctantly concluded that schooling has little or no effect on social mobility and on the achievement of greater adult equality. Reluctantly, because as a passionate liberal, he had hoped to show that it had. In fact, all his team's research work showed that equal opportunity in education guaranteed unequal results. Hussein's research confirms this. Hussein, the main architect of comprehensive education in Sweden, has published his unequivocal view that the Swedish education system has become more unequal as a result of going comprehensive. In England also, the maintained comprehensive schools, organized on a neighborhood basis, as they have to be for financial reasons, show the same divisions, often even more acutely, reflecting the extremes between downtown inner city schools and those in leafy suburbia. In fact, in Britain today, the divisions are less than they might be because many pupils use both the maintained and the independent system at different stages of their career. Very many children of all classes and backgrounds go to the maintained primary school at least until 8 or 9, and many who go to independent schools from 9 to 16 move on at 16 to the maintained sixth form colleges or further education establishments for the last stage of their pre-university schooling. Parents very properly choose the best schools they can afford for their children, whether independent or maintained. So much for class divisions and divisiveness. What of the power and influence of the elite private schools? I give you two examples of Etonians wearing formal dress. The boy on the right is wearing what is called pop dress, which is the select group who run the school, and the boy on the left is just wearing everyday formal dress. That's better, yeah.
Thank you.
Yes. He's got a rather uncolourful waistcoat compared with what they often have, the boy in pop. The following table, though published as long ago as 1973, still provides the most complete survey that I have ever seen in print and is still used by socialist critics, as it was the last general election, socialist critics of independent schools. The title, of course, is Former Independent School Pupils in Positions of Power. Apart from being out of date and yet still constantly referred to, the table is wholly inadequate as a picture of modern British society. Only 8 positions of power are listed, and of these, 3 are in the armed services, which can hardly be thought centres of great influence. The omissions are striking. Apart from directors of clearing banks, commerce and industry doesn't figure, nor do accountants, doctors, engineers, politicians, trades union leaders, or those who reach the top in universities and schools and in local government. As damaging as these omissions is the anachronism of the figures. The 65% of undersecretaries, that's about the top line, 65% of undersecretaries, for example, who held the post in 1960 and had been at private schools, were at school before the 39-45 war. The post-war social changes of free schooling for all and university education for all who could benefit from it, have only recently begun to work their way through. While it is true that nearly 50% of senior civil servants in Whitehall today were educated in private schools, what is significant is that 35 years ago, the percentage of ex-private schoolboys was much higher, 84% in 1939. Compare also the figures of intake into the administrative class, the elite civil service entry. In 1949-50, 45% were from private schools. In 1980, only 27%. With university education open to all, regardless of wealth, Whitehall has properly accepted many more candidates whose earlier schooling was in maintained grammar schools. If this admirable trend does not continue, it will only be because some comprehensive schools are not as good as the old grammar schools at developing the full intelligence of their pupils and thus securing them university places. The administrative branch of the civil service looks to university graduates for its recruits. Schools as such don't come into the reckoning. Some figures in the Times newspaper showed that 60% of successful civil service administrative class candidates came from Oxbridge, but those private school pupils who did not go to Oxbridge had less success than their maintained school counterparts. I have no more coloured slides, so perhaps we could go back to light for people to follow in the text, in the outline. Thank you very much. As for other walks of life, such as the diplomatic service, which at present still has a high percentage in its upper reaches of ex-private schoolboys, those who get into this are getting into it on their merits, not because of an old boy net. Sociologist Anthony Heath, writing in New Society, said the old school tie on its own is no longer so influential as it was. In the competition for good jobs, it is the actual level of your qualification that counts most. Qualifications count far more than the kind of school you've been to. What can be claimed for the good modern English private school is that it gives its pupils the best chance they can of getting the qualification appropriate to their level of intelligence, no more and no less. There is, of course, the special case, and I'm now at 4C for the benefit of those who've lost the place, 4C, the special case of the large number of old Etonians in Parliament. How can that be defended? Bear in mind first that they've all been elected democratically. Tawney long ago asked, do the British really want to be governed by old Etonians? Well, he replied to his own question, why do they elect them to Parliament then? The main reason for there being so many in Parliament is simply that so many political families have over the centuries chosen to send their sons to Eton. Politics is in their blood. If you come from a political family, you tend, whatever your school, to want to follow in father's footsteps. Finally, on this argument that I am advancing, consider some evidence from failure. British industry is constantly under fire these days for its old-fashioned attitudes and inefficiency. Is it altogether irrelevant that only 19% of managers in industry were educated in private schools? To critics of these schools who say that our economic decline is due to ex-private school boys holding top jobs in industry, one can reply that the decline has in fact gone hand in hand with the decrease in the number of the privately educated who are running industry. If, on the other hand, you look at one of the areas of the British economy where the country is at its most prosperous, finance, the city, you will find there the largest concentration of old Etonians and others from leading private schools. At this point, the argument extends to Oxbridge and what has been called the chain that runs from private schools to Oxbridge to the civil service. Oxford and Cambridge are regarded by some as bastions of class privilege rather than centres of academic excellence. We are attacked for admitting a higher proportion of private school students than the average for the university system, for making ourselves exclusive by setting a special entrance examination which handicaps those who haven't been specially coached for it, for playing a determining role in the formation of elites of Britain. Some critics at the last election actually went so far as to call Oxbridge a major cancer in the educational system, because in conjunction with private schools, we perpetuate an unjust and divisive class system, because our graduates obtain the most influential jobs in the civil service and numerous other professions, because we constitute the widest Freemasonry of all, with a disproportionate influence on the rest of education. That was all out of the Labour Party's campaign pamphlet at the last election. Let me expose this myth by three arguments. This is now paragraph 5. The figures, Oxbridge's traditional clientele, Oxbridge's long-term entry policy. While it is true that just under half of the Oxbridge places go annually to those educated in private schools, and only 6% of children are in these schools, it's important to realise that 18% of the country's sixth formers, the clever children who go on to the sixth form, are in them. And the success rates of applicants from different types of school is a much more relevant consideration. These rates are very similar for maintained and independent. For example, in 1984, 43% of applicants and 37% of those accepted were from maintained schools, while 39% of applicants and 49% of those accepted were from independent schools. The percentages of applications and acceptances being 52% in both cases for maintained schools, and a slightly higher percentage of acceptance, 20%, than of application, 16%, of the independent schools. And that is how the figures have shown up for some years. A slightly higher rate of success from schools with good academic sixth forms on the strength of their higher GCE advanced level grades, that's our leaving examination. One in five of those taking advanced level at private schools achieve grade A, the top grade, as compared to one in 11 at the maintained comprehensive schools. Now, this success rate is also partly attributable to the considerable pre-selection made in private schools, which have long experience of Oxbridge academic standards. These schools put forward only their best pupils, those they really think have a good chance of success. So on three scores, excellent teaching, knowing the standard required, and careful weeding out of all but a select few, it would be rather odd if the private schools, which now include the former direct grant grammar schools, prestigious academic establishments creaming the most intelligent of some large children from some large conurbations such as Manchester, Leeds and Bradford, did not do slightly better in the success rate of their applications. Secondly, Why don't more pupils from comprehensive schools apply to Oxbridge? Why do maintained schools supply over 73% of university students, but only just over 50% to Oxbridge? Partly, no doubt, because of out-of-date views of what Oxford and Cambridge are like today, a picture of an upper-class world, reinforced, alas, by television films of a pre-war era, such as Brideshead Revisited, which I think has been out in Canada too, portraying, for instance, the disgusting behaviour of a drunk aristocrat at Oxford. But much more significantly, because most of the pupils are still, regrettably, are drawn to schools in the north, whose pupils naturally and properly think first of the great civic universities of the north, Manchester, Liverpool, Leeds, Sheffield, Nottingham. Why should they go south, far from their homes, when their schools have long and strong traditional links with nearby universities? Is it not rather arrogant of Oxbridge to expect otherwise? Thirdly, Oxbridge's long-term policy. All colleges are anxious to increase the numbers that they admit from comprehensive schools for two reasons. First, they want their admission system to be seen to be as fair as in fact it is. That is, that academic quality is what they're on the lookout for rather than anything else. In 1984, 82% of Oxford and 88% of Cambridge post A-level entrance had scored 13 or more points out of 15 at A-level, that is the top level of all, that is a grade A plus two grade Bs at least. 82% at Oxford and 88% had scored that level as compared with 28% at other universities. Secondly, Oxbridge knows that there must be some extremely able pupils in the comprehensive schools who would benefit from being at Oxbridge and would benefit Oxford and Cambridge by being there. And so Oxbridge colleges have done and continue to do all they can to encourage applicants from maintained schools, and with some success. In 1938-9, for example, at Oxford, 74.6% of all male undergraduates came from the private sector, 19.2% from the maintained schools, the rest from overseas. In 1965-6, the figure of male undergraduates from maintained schools had more than doubled to just over 40%. By 1982-3, this had risen to over half, 51%. They have recently revised their entry systems again to make them as open and fair as possible to pupils from every type of school. But of course, it remains the case that academically selective schools, which in modern Britain are now predominantly the private schools, get proportionately more of their pupils into academically selective Oxford and Cambridge than the comprehensive schools, which cater, after all, for a much wider range of intelligence. It would be strange if it were otherwise. But this brings us on to the question of academic selection, which I promised earlier to discuss as the third front of the assault on private schools. And we're now at paragraph 6. Because I believe that the mobilization to the fullest extent possible of the natural intelligence of all our children is necessary for a country's social well-being, culture, and economic prosperity, and that this depends on some selection in secondary education, I deplore those who argue against. At the most extreme, their thinking is dominated by dislike of what has been called the same old binary classification as before: sheep and goats, saved and damned, them and us. Few would disagree that all children of whatever academic ability should receive a good and appropriate education. But the sheep and goats classification used by the anti-selectionists is far too simplistic to be helpful. Some academic selection at some point, preferably later than 11 plus, which in England proved to be too soon, perhaps rather at 14 plus or even 16, and not necessarily in a different type of school, does not of itself produce two groups of saved and damned. What is important is that methods of academic classification for particular social purposes, for example, the training of skilled workers or top-level civil servants, should not carry with them judgments of overall social value. The fact that a boy or girl happens to have intelligence fitted for a university and therefore needs a particular type of academic education should not introduce concepts of social superiority and inferiority. What any dynamic country needs, and I want to repeat what I said earlier, is a variety of creative groups with particular skills to offer to the community at large. In short, a whole range of elites. No one objects to special schools for ballet dancers or musicians, and we have those. Why object so passionately to special schools for the academically most gifted? What is needed in our country, in our schools, in colleges and universities, is that quality, in whatever form it is found, should be valued, that skill and talent should be esteemed, not denigrated. And this is where equality comes in for consideration again. For quality and equality seem irreconcilable, and yet both are thought desirable. Can the irreconcilability be overcome? In the time remaining this evening, I can only pick out a few central points from the many that philosophers, educationists, and others have raised. First, almost all people, certainly all who have had children that I've ever met, recognize fundamental genetic inequality. We all know that we have different characters and qualities, and that these are not all the result of environment. Cyrano de Bergerac's father had a large nose too. The curious thing here is that most of us are normally ready to admit, indeed sometimes to be proud, of inherited physical characteristics, but not so often of mental ones. May I here, to enliven the closing stages of my lecture and to make sure that everybody is awake for the last part, tell you an illustrative story, the story of the pickpocket's child. Mother and father had met and fallen in love at first sight while working the same theatre queue. Having, unknown to each other, started picking the pockets at opposite ends of the queue and meeting in the middle. In due course, they married to the strains of "Thy hand, O Lord, has guided thy flock from age to age." And again, in due course, a child was born to them. But unfortunately, the little boy was born with a deformed right hand, the fingers being tightly clasped together. And nothing the mother or the father or the general practitioner could do would straighten those little fingers out. Finally, in desperation, the parents consulted a specialist. And after he had questioned them closely about themselves and their background, he drew out a gold watch and swung it backwards and forwards slowly before the baby's eyes. Immediately, the child's fingers of its right hand unclasped as they stretched towards the watch, and out of its hand fell the midwife's wedding ring. Heredity, you see, will out. We're not born equal in endowment or character. Secondly, we need to recognize the deceptive nature of the apparently simple term equal. Essentially, it is a relative term and needs always to be used relatively. Because everyone understands its meaning when used a physical measurement of distance, weight, time, many think they know what they're doing when they use the term in a social or political sense. Aristotle, as long ago as the 4th century BC, warned that while justice considers that persons who are equal should have assigned to them equal things, the difficult and crucial question is equals and unequals in what? For example, the word is often connected with justice and humanity, but in each case it is a different equality. In the first, it is what J.R. Lucas has called equity, the weak principle of universalizability, that the only restriction on a decision which a judge might reach rationally is that similar cases should be treated similarly. This has no egalitarian implications whatever. In the second, the common humanity of all men entitles them to equality of respect. This is a different equality, indeed incompatible with the first, and cannot be combined with it to promote egalitarianism. For at root, egalitarianism is a form of envy. As Nozick has put it very clearly, the envious man prefers neither one having it, whatever it may be, to the others having it and his not having it. If equality was the most important value, it would, as Mary Warnock has argued, be objectively better if neither of two people had some good than if one had it and the other did not. If I am thinking of myself and another person, it is envy. If I am thinking in general terms of any two people, whether or not one is myself, it is egalitarianism. A good illustration of this is the egalitarian attitude to the 11-plus examination in England. When it was introduced in 1945 and was thought to be giving children equality of opportunity in secondary education, giving all a chance to get a foot on the educational ladder, it had a strong egalitarian approval. When a few years later it was seen that the opportunities given did not effect an equal outcome, that some climbed higher than others and some never made the first rung, the 11-plus came under strong egalitarian attack. What egalitarians failed to realize was that if all cannot reach the top, there is bound to be some form of competition to get there. And if there is equality of opportunity, the best will win, which thus brings about inequality. As D.E. Cooper expressed it, there are empirical reasons why we shall never have excellence and equality, because we shall never have a situation in which everyone reaches a level attained by some. In any situation where there is equality, it would be semantically improper for persons in that situation to describe the level attained as one of excellence, for excellence is a grading word, and where there are no gradations, there is nothing to refer to as excellent. But much more important than that semantic point is the essential human desire to aim higher on which it is based. To aim at excellence is a human characteristic. As Cooper says, if everyone could reach a level which previously only a few had reached, this concern would lead to envisaging improvements, raising the sights to a new target, which by its nature only a few can foreseeably reach. Sane egalitarians do not demand equality at any level, but at the highest level generally attainable. But we must first identify what can be attained, and this can only be done with confidence by seeing some actually attain it, and this requires inequality. Thus, equality could at best be no more than a momentarily acceptable state. While then I believe that we must accept semantically and practically that quality and equality, as used by egalitarians, are fundamentally irreconcilable, there are two simple and obvious aspects of the word equality, one of which I mentioned just now, which seem to me to lie at the heart of most ordinary people's use of and attitude to this word. These are the aspects that for many give the word its political and social power. What people want, surely, is first self-recognition, and secondly, a fair deal for themselves. This first aspect of equality, then, is equality of respect or of consideration, equality in uniqueness. Each of us counts, and each of us should be equally valued as a human being for our distinct and different contribution, at whatever level, to the welfare of the community in which we live. And such mutual respect has no connection with uniformity. A change of external conditions may make this easier to achieve. For example, at the factory which produces Mars bars and a whole lot of other chocolates in Slough, in Buckinghamshire, the managing director and the workforce feed together in the same canteen at the same tables, use the same washing facilities and the same car park, and the manager doesn't have a special place marked out for him. There is no differentiation between blue and white collar workers. This equality is most effective. Mars don't have strikes. But the same effect, of course, can be achieved by good personal relations, as we all know, what has felicitously been called the chat factor. That is, an attitude of employer to employee that really does spring from genuinely felt respect. And those who support this aspect of equality are not hypocritical in accepting the natural diversity of the human race, indeed making the most of it, while only seeming to remove differences that handicap the individual. It is this fundamentally considerate approach to our fellows, not looking down on others, or for that matter up to others, that I believe we should all cultivate, not just schools. The second aspect of equality arises naturally from the first, and is connected with the concepts of justice and fairness. As the philosopher Frankina put it, the just society must, so far as possible, provide equally the conditions under which its members can, by their own efforts, achieve the best lives of which they are capable. There must, for example, be no racial, sex, or religious discrimination. All citizens must be equal before the law, must have equal opportunities matching their abilities for earning their living. But equality of outcome or result cannot be achieved, let alone guaranteed, and is not desirable. Even Rawls admits that after several basic liberties have been guaranteed for all, social justice allows some inequality, provided that it can be shown to benefit the worst off in society. If we mind about the quality of life, I do not believe we should aim at more. As Ian Gilmore has expressed it, since men are unequal, they can only be made equal economically by being treated unequally. This is likely to be neither fair nor civilized. Our culture, our way of life, will be irreparably impoverished unless we reward skill properly. Thomas Arnold, the headmaster of rugby to whom Mr. Vogel referred, said, "Raise all, lower none." Carlyle said, "Levelling is comfortable, yet only down to oneself." To attack excellence is to promote mediocrity. Envy, said Rawls, tends to make everyone worse off. In a fully socialist society, everyone has less for fear that anyone has too much. But it is important that all forms of excellence, not simply the academic, should be esteemed. Surgeons must indeed be educated to the highest level, but skills at all levels need the fullest development, and the more routes to esteem that there are, the less possible will it be to restrict the groups to two, sheep and goats, haves and have-nots, the workers and the wealthy, the proles and their masters. At the same time, however, a just society requires a living standard above that which I described at the outset of this lecture. The pursuit of the first sort of excellence not only need not militate against that sort of equality, I believe that it should positively help to achieve it for all. Yes, Father, yes.
Mr. McCrum has agreed to take questions. Just a moment, please.
Could the percentage of Oxford engagement... Alas, I haven't got the percentage of Oxford women separate.
We'll have to repeat the question.
Yes, sorry, repeat the question. You wanted to know the percentage of women enrollment at Oxford. I can tell you that the national percentage of women in universities, in all universities, is, I saw it recently, 41.3%. in all universities. Oxford and Cambridge have been going co-residential in recent years, and the last time I saw a figure, it was 35% in the universities. In my own university at Cambridge, I think it's about that. For example, in my own college, which has only fairly recently gone co-residential, it's still just about 30%. But we're hoping to get it up to about 40% over the next few years.
Behind the bar at the back.
What fraction of what we would call high school students in this country actually attend post-secondary education in Britain?
About 15%, I think, altogether. If you include in post-secondary education polytechnics, there's almost as many people in polytechnics as there are in universities, which are very similar to universities in the sense that they teach advanced courses, but the accent is on the much more vocational courses, and they're non-residential. They're mostly institutions which people visit by the day.
Yes, in the corner.
The class sizes in independent schools are, I believe, significantly smaller than those in comprehensive schools or even in some of the maintained grammar schools. I wonder if you could comment on what the effect of the quality of opportunity is as a result of the difference in size, class size.
Well, there's some...
Did everybody hear that question? Is there a relationship between class size and quality of education?
Sure. Sorry. There's a lot of argument about this by educationists, whether there is a relationship. I personally, having taught myself class sizes ranging from 30 down to 2 or 3, I'm quite certain that there is a relationship between class size and effectiveness. Depends on the subject, of course, and what you're trying to achieve. As to the class size in the independent schools as compared with the maintained schools, you certainly find that in both sorts of school, the average size is often around 24, between 20, 25, 26. The idea that all the maintained schools classes are over 30 and rising 40, 50 is nonsense. On average, it is perfectly true to say that most maintained schools will have rather larger class sizes than independent schools. But it's also true to say that the clever children in comprehensive schools are often in very small groups because there aren't very many of them, for obvious reasons. And therefore, that you can't argue that, in fact, sometimes you can find that there are smaller groups of them in comprehensive schools than you'd find in maintained schools. At Eton, for example, the many sixth form groups, A-level classes, would be 15 children. Now, there are not quite a lot of comprehensive schools, but regard 15 children being taught A-level at the same time as much too large. So it's not an easy question to give a direct answer to. There's a lot of variety and a lot of variation between schools, whether they're maintained or private.
Yes, here.
Mr. Graham Campbell was only able to stage a production of ruling class people because the administration was slightly confused after you left, didn't quite realize what was going on. And the controversial play Another Country was only allowed because Mr. Anderson might have realized what the subject matter was about a few days before the performances were scheduled to begin. And these two examples, I think, bring up something that I found wrong with the school, was that there was no real attempt at an internal discussion about the subject, nor was there an attempt to tell an ill-informed public
rights at
schools no longer existed. Surely the situation would be better
than such discussion was actively pursued. That's a very esoteric set of observations that I will try and... Here is obviously an old Italian who I recognise talking about particular problems in the school relating to the production of Another Country, which is a film and a play largely concerned with the subject of homosexuality. And he's arguing that there ought to be more public discussion of issues of that type. I agree entirely. I think there ought to be discussion of issues of that type. And one of the interesting things about the topic, homosexuality, as related to the English independent boarding school, is that people still think that these schools are hotbeds of homosexual malpractice. Now, when I was a boy at school, I hope you'll forgive the reminiscence on this, when I was a boy at school, everyone in authority was terribly worried and anxious about this topic. And we were not, as children, I was not allowed, for example, to talk to anybody who was more than a year older than myself, seen around with anybody more than a year older than myself, in case it, you know, there might be some suspicion that senior boys were getting at one in some way. And similarly, we were not allowed to visit other boys' houses. We were kept to our own year group all the time. And this is, of course, ludicrous. And since the war in the 56 and so on, the whole atmosphere in independent schools, to my mind, has improved greatly. Boys and girls can visit anybody they like in different houses. They can talk to whom they want to. There's a freedom of discussion. There's no question of being limited to your own age group. And although there is, of course, homosexuality in independent boarding schools, there is at that level of age, that age level, that age group, all across the country at any sort of school. I don't myself believe that today that independent schools have any more of this, of bad practices in this respect, than in other sorts of schools. And I think that the picture that portrayed in another country, well, it was quite specifically written by people who knew a period earlier. And I think it's also true to say that the whole idea of a single-sex boarding school does become more and more, seems more and more in the modern world to be an out-of-date concept. I personally lived in it, been a boy in one and taught in one and so on for most of my working life, and therefore have only recently come to terms with the idea that co-education, co-residence at university is really a better way forward. I'm now totally convinced, and my own college has gone co-residential since I became master, and I think it's the best thing for that college. Asked me that question when I was senior tutor there in the 50s, I'd have thought your head needed examining. And I think any senior tutor in Cambridge asked in the 50s whether he thought his college should be co-residential and girls and boys should be, young men and women should be living side by side in the same institution residentially, would have been thought pretty strange.
Yes, Ms. Nimet. No, just a moment, please.
Most of us believe in some sort of meritocracy. How do you get around the accent that you meet so often in really bright students who graduate from the comprehensive school?
The question I'm being asked is, started off by saying, most of us believe in meritocracy. How do we get over the question of accent, the difference of accent between those educated in independent schools and those educated in maintained comprehensive schools? I don't think this is a real problem. It's certainly true that in England, much more than in any other country that I know of, you can assess a person's social position or position in one sense very accurately by his accent. Not only whether it's a dialect accent, but the particular refinements of accent. And people can identify almost the street you were born in by your accent if you're clever. We all know Professor Higgins in G.B. Shaw's play. But in my experience at Cambridge, both in the 50s and again now, is that it doesn't really matter whether you speak with a... what sort of accent you speak with, provided you believe in yourself and you're intelligent and have self-confidence. It doesn't depend on accent or not whether you make progress. I think that is generally true. I think if you've got a very pronounced accent of a local dialect, then it sometimes inhibits until people get to know you. It certainly doesn't hold people back in the modern university that they don't speak with what we might call an Oxford accent or in the Queen's English. You're treated in universities today, I think, by and large, there may be exceptions, but by and large, for what you are, the sort of person you are, your achievements in your subject, not on what I would think are really peripheral issues, not essential matters such as whether you speak one way or another.
Just a moment, I'll go back.
time in the graduate school, to what extent do you think government should subsidize economically disadvantaged children to the great benefits of society and not to go to these schools, and indeed give tax breaks to the parents, the people who do send their children?
Have you lost your mic?
I'm not quite sure I got grasped a hold of that the point of question.
If the private schools academically credited to be made described in the client
school, yes.
To what extent do you think the government should subsidize
Subsidize who?
The economically disadvantaged.
The economically disadvantaged. Yes, yes. Sorry, I didn't hear you the first time. I myself believe very strongly in that we ought to introduce a voucher system, and that people should be able to choose what school they want to go to, and that the difference should be made up by the government, so that intelligent children should be able to get to schools which suit them. And of course, one of the very sad things about the removal of the direct grant by the last Labour government was that this did take away the opportunities that were there for intelligent children whose parents hadn't got funds to send them to independent schools to get a good academic education for them. And what I do think that the government of today in England, present Tory government, has tried to restore some of the direct grant by this assisted places scheme. And the assisted places scheme, which is gives independent schools finance to provide places for children who can't afford the fees, has been, in my view, very successful, and it could well be extended. So already the government, the present government, is providing assisted places for children whose parents can't afford the fees at independent schools where they need it for intellectual reasons. And the present government say they're going to extend that further, but equally, on the other side, the Labour Party say they will remove the assisted places scheme, they will destroy it, they will get rid of it as soon as they come back into power, so that it's a temporary situation. It would be very nice to feel it's going to be extended over a longer period.
Yes, behind, just behind.
If I could reminisce a little from Dr.
Cameron. Not too much, please.
Briefly, in the 50s, and I well recall there were no women there. I was constrained in trying to find a wife from the other place. Another thing I recall of Cambridge in the 50s is that at every new social encounter, one was introduced by one's college and one's school. So the social class was came right up front in every new social encounter. If I could say a couple of things about entrance in Oxford and Cambridge.
Could we have the question, please?
I know you're pointing down.
Could we have your question?
I'm not allowed to make up the rest.
Well, we can't afford too much time. Please have your question.
I was hoping to make a contribution.
No, we can't afford that. If you have your question, we'll take it. If you haven't, I'll go to another
yes.
question.
I wonder, sir, if the speaker is aware that one possible factor in the inequality of entrance to Oxford and Cambridge from the two kinds of support that you're talking about is that for a long time, if not still, the examinations for entrance to Oxford and Cambridge occur generally, in the third year of a sixth form, by which stage the state examinations have been taken, so that there's an economic factor built in right there. At that point, many people from the grammar school wish to leave school and earn some money, rather than still they got the property examination. And is he aware that...
Could you mind stopping there, please? Thank you.
He is aware. He actually mentioned the Oxford and Cambridge are trying to meet this point, which is a very important point. And Oxford now have shifted their entrance examination to the fourth term in the sixth form, that is two-thirds of the way through, a sixth former's career so that all children have the same, take the exam at the same time, and they've abandoned the seventh term entry, which was geared to the independent schoolboy, and Cambridge is doing the same, but not the same as Oxford, but also abandoning the seventh term entrance examination, so that the built-in advantage that used to exist for independent schoolboys who had had extra teaching in that seventh term will cease as from next year. We've got one more of these seventh term entrance examinations, then Cambridge, I think, is going to be much more sensible than Oxford, by having our examination for entry for all schools at precisely the same time as they're being examined for A-level in the sixth term. So they'll take a few extra papers in that term, slightly earlier or slightly later. We haven't finally settled.
Thank you. Now, Davey? Here, yes. Pat? Why did Oxford deny an honorary degree to the Prime Minister?
I'm very happy to try to read the minds of the Oxford people concerned. I speak, of course, from a prejudiced point of view. The Hebdomadal Council, which decided to offer Margaret Thatcher an honorary degree, had, to my not certain knowledge, but I think fairly definitely, had thought about this honor and went to offer it to her on at least two, if not three, earlier occasions. First, when she was, because she's a graduate of Oxford, of course, and a very distinguished graduate of Oxford, and when she was elected leader of the Tory party, when she was first prime minister, and thirdly, when the Falklands War was successfully achieved, finished. And on each case, they decided that it must be the wrong moment. And they then finally chose, the moment that they did choose, was one when she, her government had recently cut back university funds very substantially. So I think it's really more a matter of timing than anything.
Good morning.
What percentage of students in Eton are scholarship students or government assisted students?
What percentage of students at Eton are assisted by the government in any way? None. What we do have at Eton is a college. At Eton, the whole name of Eton, of course, is Eton College, but at Eton itself, we talk about the school, which is the Oppidans, and college, which is the 70 scholars. And the 70 scholars are on the foundation and are funded by the endowments of the college and go back to the foundation. And originally, there were just 70 scholars. And these are all free places if parents don't have the money to send their children. The academic standard is very high to get a place in college, but if you get a place in college and if you can't afford to go there, you get the full grant from the foundation to pay for you. In addition to those 70 places, the college, a few years ago, about 10 years ago, introduced a new scheme of junior scholarships for children from poorer homes at primary school level at the age of 10 who take papers in mathematics and English and intelligence papers, and we tried to widen the social entry by this way. It's very expensive. We offered 6 a year, and I believe that my successor is offering more still, for 8 years, free places at Eton if the parents would like to take them up. 3 years at the preparatory school to get the boys up to the standard academic standard required for entry, and then 5 further years at the school. If they get into college, then of course they displace others who would have come in other ways. The trouble with the college system is that over the years it has tended, most of the college places tend to be taken up by those who've gone to the English preparatory schools, which are again, if you like, elitist schools, schools which are fee-paying schools and where parents who can afford to get the smaller classes and better teaching send their children between the ages of 8 and 13. So out of 1,300 boys, there are about 70 boys in college and probably another dozen or so around the school, maybe a few more, who are funded by the endowments of the college. But there are no government places in the school. There was a period up to about 10 years ago when one or two counties in England, like provinces in Canada, but on a smaller scale. One or two counties, Hertfordshire, for instance, provided a free place at Eton, Winchester, and Rugby, and we had one every year from Hertfordshire, and very good boys they were too. But alas, the socialists took over the Hertfordshire Education Authority, and that scheme was stopped. That was a throwback to the original Fleming report recommendations of the war years.
Yes, here.
This chap has been good for a long time.
I'll get to you before we're finished, but here.
How do you make it possible for the quote of the baby in Harlem, the child in Harlem, the equivalent of a boy or a child in his social position, his status, to be able to go to the higher Ivy League schools in the States? And is it possible? There are miracle stories like Margaret Thatcher's, where a person from the lower class of society rise up to the very top. This is more of an exception rather than a rule of upward social mobility. How do you make it possible for the people from the lower classes to rise to the top? And how do you solve the problem of the higher education of being as a social symbol of a power status symbol?
Well, I mean, this is what we've been discussing. I think it is. I think that the social mobility, which, as I said, quoting from P.T. Barr's book, is very much greater than the average citizen realizes. And it isn't restricted to Margaret Thatcher's of this world. Certainly the Margaret Thatcher's as well, and Lloyd George and Heath and James Callaghan and others you can think of. I took those as obvious examples in political sense sphere. But you can think of a whole lot of other people in all walks of life who have made it to the top, not necessarily through universities, by sheer personality and determination in England today, despite our class system. But having said that, I think there's no question that the university, the way through the university, through graduation at a university, and getting to university isn't all that difficult. You don't have to have a tremendous amount of intellectual power to get to university. And when you're there, again, the opportunities open up for graduates, again, on the basis of intellectual and personality. Intellect and personality. It isn't just intellect, but the two together. And I think that the more you can get going to universities who need to the university education, the better. What we're all worried about, and I dare say Canada is too, we've been worried about for a long time, is that the citizens, the working class, or the fifth grade in the Registrar General's classification, the unskilled manual worker, his children do not go to university. They don't want to go to university. They don't get pushed towards it by anybody. Their family tradition is not in that direction. And we're all trying to think of ways of persuading them to think in terms of university. Some of them are very intelligent, and we would like to see them there. But there are very few of them who come through, and they're the ones one would like to see being encouraged to come on to university. And they had a much better chance when there were these grammar schools than there are now.
I'll take two more, and I have them. One here.
I'd like to know whether you believe the British diplomatic service is much more effective than the much criticized industrial sector, and why you refer to genetic inequality when no norm of reaction has been established for any human characteristic.
Two very different questions there. I would be hesitant to say anything about the diplomatic service. The question really was, the first question was, would you like to say it again? About the diplomatic service.
Whether the diplomatic service is in fact more effective than industrial
leadership. Yes, is the diplomatic service more effective than the industrial leadership in England? And that, I think, is a huge question. It would be very
difficult to judge. Obviously, the selection of the diplomatic service is very carefully worked out, and a very high standard of entrant gets into the diplomatic service. There are, of course, critics of it, as some people think that it's a too specialist cadre that is produced by the system. I think that at the top level it's very good indeed, but I think at the top level our industrial leadership is also very good indeed. Equally, I think that there are some diplomats who don't go as far as to the top and who aren't particularly good, and quite a lot of industrialists aren't very effective either. I think it's very difficult to draw any conclusions about these two hugely different walks of life, and I'd be hesitant to try. I think that our diplomatic service is regarded highly in the world at large and is not criticised in England at any rate to anything like the same extent as our industrial leadership. That's all I can really say. On the subject of genes and genetic characteristics and so on, this again is a topic which always raises enormous amount of controversy when anybody ever talks about genetic endowment. And there are books on it, as I'm sure our questioner knows. And I'm not a specialist, but I have read a good deal in the works of those who are writing on genes. Isaac, for example, who I know is a controversial figure. But I speak, and I think most of us here speak, from our own knowledge of our families and ourselves. And all I can say is that observing human nature around the world and observing